Morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Leo, for playing the Shakuhachi. That was beautiful. We really appreciate that. Good morning. So this is all set? Okay. Well, today I'm going to be talking about the life and teachings of Yasodhara. Yasodhara was Siddhartha's wife before he became the Buddha. And I'll be talking about five teachings from Yasodhara. This is a very old version of the origins of Buddhism. It's a teaching tale. All Buddhist stories are teaching tales. And this is among the oldest. This is among the oldest of the teaching tales. So old, in fact, that to reconstruct this story, people had to dig through the literature of some of the earliest known Buddhist schools. These schools haven't even existed for nearly 2,000 years. So it's a big job reconstructing this story, this ancient story. It's not an orchestrated effort either. It's more of a grassroots type thing. Some of the people that are involved in reconstructing this myth are listed on your program, and along with some of the sources that this story came from. So Yasodhara, her story begins in the time of Dipankara Buddha, which is the Buddha that preceded Shakyamuni Buddha. And during the time of Dipankara Buddha, Yasodhara was called Sumita. She's known by many names, which is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to, you know, reconstruct her story. But during the time of Dipankara Buddha, one of the names that she was known by is Sumita, and her husband was Sumedha. So when Dipankara Buddha came to their village to teach the Dharma, so the story goes, he recognized them, and he told them that they were joined in a spiritual quest for liberation, and that this quest would last many lifetimes. So they were joined in a vow. They were joined in a vow to attain complete spiritual freedom, and they were committed to support each other in this quest in every way until they attained complete spiritual liberation. Then Dipankara Buddha told them that Sumedha would be the next Buddha, and he would be known as Shakyamuni Buddha. So that's the story of how Yasodhara and Buddha began with a vow. So a vow is not a goal that we can strive to attain. A vow defines how we intend to live our lives. A vow, by definition, is unattainable, because if it could be attained, then it's a goal. And once we attain our goals, then the goal dies. But vows don't die. They can be abandoned, but they don't die. And this story that takes place in the timeless past, in timelessness, it gives us an image of two people who are embraced in and embraced by an eternal vow. And that vow will nourish them through lifetimes of sorrow and disappointment and discouragement and heartache, because vows are powerful. If we make them with our whole heart, they're powerful. And their vow will provide each of them with a path and a means. But it will not provide them with a destination. It was made in the timeless past, in the mythological time of Dipankara Buddha, and it extends into the timeless future. We are being nourished by that vow right now, right here in this Zendo. So the first teaching of Yasodhara is about living and vow. Living and vow. So now we're going to make the leap from the timeless past to the merely distant past. To about the time of 563 BCE. And I'm going to read a passage from an article written by Jacqueline Kramer. She's one of the people listed on your program. She's a Buddhist teacher and an author who lives in California. So this is from an article that she wrote for a magazine. In a kingdom nestled in a fruitful region fed by the Ganges River, there lived a king by the name of Supabuddha and his queen, Pamita. Good news had come to them. The queen was pregnant. At the same time, in a nearby city of Kapilavastu, the king's younger brother, King Suddhodana, was also expecting a child. These were not to be ordinary children. They both had the auspicious signs of either being a great scholar or great religious leader. Because of this, it was proclaimed that both children were to be sons. But this was not to be the case for King Supabuddha's child, who was born a female. Disappointed that his child was a girl, but honored at her auspicious signs, the king bowed down before her, and her name was Yasodhara. So that's about the birth of Yasodhara. And Yasodhara, the name Yasodhara, means glorious one. So, even though she was a princess, at the young age of about 12 or 13, Yasodhara began to go out into the surrounding villages and work with the poorest of the poor. Now, she was not mentored to do this. She was not taught to do this. She was not even encouraged to do this. It came from the depth of her heart. It came from her vow. She didn't even remember making a vow in the timeless past. But we don't need to remember. We just need to follow our heart, because vows are made with the heart. So according to Thich Nhat Hanh, who is also one of the people listed on your program, Yasodhara would go into the poor villages and tend to the children who were suffering from eye diseases or influenza or skin disorders. She rinsed their infected eyes and skin. She dispensed medicine, and she washed their clothes. She hoped that other royals would follow her example, but of course none of them ever did. So she worked alone. She worked alone. So engaged Buddhism is kind of a hot topic today. But with the resurrection of Yasodhara's myth, we see that engagement has always been an important part of Buddhism, right from the very beginning. All we have to do is reconstruct this very ancient myth. So the second teaching of Yasodhara has to do with social responsibility, with engagement, full engagement with the world. So the first time she met Prince Siddhartha was at a martial arts competition, which of course he won. And Princess Yasodhara was the one who presented the prize to the winner. And that prize was a white elephant. So, in Buddhist mythology, the elephant represents the noble gentleness and kind and calm majesty of one who is on the path. So the elephant in Buddhist mythology is, in Hindu mythology actually, is a symbol of inner strength. And there are four components of inner strength. And these four components, according to the symbology, these four components are aspiration, intention, effort, and analysis. So aspiration. To aspire is to breathe life into. And Yasodhara's aspiration was to live in vow. Aspiration is breath by breath. So if we forget our vow one moment, with the very next breath, it can be alive in our life again. So compelled by her great aspiration, she went every day with wholehearted intention. Intention, that's the second component, to help those who were suffering. So her intention was to manifest her vow through helping others, and it took great effort. And she was educated. This is the fourth component, analysis. She studied the Vedas, just like Siddhartha did. So she knew the importance of cultivating both the heart and the mind. So aspiration, intention, effort, and analysis are called the four boundless powers. The four boundless powers. And they are directly associated with Yasodhara, because she was the bearer of this prize. It was her offering to Siddhartha. Hi. Hi. No seats. So sometimes it seems like some people just naturally seem to have these wonderful, boundless powers, and others don't. But inner strength is something that we cultivate. It's not something that we're born with. So the third teaching of Yasodhara is that we cultivate inner strength through the development of aspiration, effort, intention, and analysis. And we develop those things through our work helping others, through our charitable work. So the next time that Prince Siddhartha and Princess Yasodhara met, it was by accident. He was going for a ride through one of the neighboring villages with his attendant, a man named Chana. And Yasodhara was there tending to the children. Here's what Thich Nhat Hanh wrote about that day. He said, "That day, Siddhartha had a chance to speak with Yasodhara. He was surprised to learn that she shared many of his own ideas. Yasodhara was not content to blindly follow tradition. She too had studied the Vedas and secretly opposed society's injustices. Since the day he first saw her, when she presented him with the elephant, Siddhartha had felt a special affinity for Yasodhara. His father had expressed a desire for him to marry soon. Perhaps Yasodhara was the right woman." So that was from Thich Nhat Hanh. And of course she was the right woman. But she was advised by not only her father, but by others, she was advised not to marry Siddhartha, because it was well known that he was destined to be a spiritual leader, and that he would leave her. He would leave her to seek enlightenment, because that's what spiritual leaders did in those days. So she was advised not to marry him. But she knew this. She knew it in her heart. She knew that he would be leaving to seek enlightenment, and she would support him in every way that she could, because it was their vow. And he would support her in every way that he could, because it was their vow. So they were married at the age of 16. They're both the same age, remember. So they were married at the age of 16. And after they were married, Siddhartha's father, King Suddhodana, showered them with all sorts of luxuries. Palace for every season, grand entertainment. But they weren't interested in that kind of life. They were interested in the renewal of society. And they didn't need any of that, because they were supported. They were fully supported by this eternal vow that they were embraced both in and embraced by. So they didn't need anything else. So Siddhartha studied with well-known Brahmins and monks, and he shared what he had learned with Yasodhara. And they began to meditate together regularly. Yasodhara continued her work with the poor every day, but she also always reserved time to meditate. So the path that Yasodhara represents is not a path of renunciation. It's not a path of separation from the world. It's one of full engagement with the world. And in his book, the Venerable Ananda Maitreya, who is a Sri Lankan monk and Pali scholar, he had this to say about Yasodhara. He said, "Princess Yasodhara was an extraordinary person of the same peculiar type as Prince Arthur." Prince Siddhartha. Matching him in every way. Thich Nhat Hanh said that even though she was a princess and she was educated, she was also a woman. So she was limited in what she could do. So she was limited by a culture that was not very friendly to women. But we're all limited in what we can do. And we're not limited in the same way that Yasodhara was limited, but we're all limited in what we can do. But we can accept those limitations, and we can work with them just as Yasodhara did. We don't have to be discouraged by them, and we can realize, again, that everybody, men and women, no matter how rich and powerful they are, we all work within our limitations. So I remember reading an article many years ago about Mother Teresa. And she was asked about how she stayed motivated. And she said she gets up in the morning and she goes about her work according. She prioritized her daily activities according to what needed to be done. And everything else was secondary. So Yasodhara went into the poor villages and she worked according to what needed to be done. So it wasn't about being motivated or being encouraged or discouraged. It wasn't about limitations or no limitations. It was simply according. So working with limitations is the fourth teaching of Yasodhara. And working with our limitations requires analysis, which is the fourth component of inner strength. So working with limitations, we cultivate inner strength. So Yasodhara continued her work every day, and she worked so hard with the poorest of the poor that her husband, Prince Siddhartha, became very concerned about her. How long would she be able to endure such sorrow and heartache day after day? And a pivotal day came after they'd been married for about 12 years. So they were about 28 years old at this time. And Yasodhara went out into one of the villages and she worked very hard with a young child who was very ill, trying to save the life of this young child. But in spite of all of her efforts, the child died. So she arrived back to the palace that evening, completely distraught. And Prince Siddhartha saw her deep despair, and there was nothing he could do for her. There was no way he could comfort her. There was no way that he could ease her pain. And this sight of his wife, who he loved very much, in such deep despair, and his own helplessness, created a splinter that pierced his heart. And that splinter would remain there. Because this splinter in his heart was the manifestation of his eternal vow. he was being summoned. Less than a year later, their son was born. And Prince Siddhartha, whose name means every wish fulfilled, named his son Rahula, which means fetter. Fetter. Now, in the dictionary, the definition of fetter is a chain or shackle placed on the feet, or anything that confines or restrains. So why did he do that? Didn't he love his son? Didn't he love his son? Why did he do that? I think he named him Fetter because his love for him was so strong that for the first time, Siddhartha was conflicted about his vow. If he hadn't been conflicted about his vow, then his son would not have been a fetter. And he could have named him Mark or Steve. So it was his love for his son that was the fetter. But the splinter was still in his heart. He was still being summoned by his vow. So what a heartbreaking dilemma. So Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story about Siddhartha and his new family going for a carriage ride. Siddhartha and Yasodhara and young Rahula. And Chana was driving the carriage. And suddenly he stopped the carriage because there was a man lying in the road. So they all got out, checked on this man, and realized that he was dying of a horrible disease that was known to have no cure. So Siddhartha went to the man, and he held his hand. He held his hand while he passed away. And Chana, the attendant, of course, kept trying to convince Prince Siddhartha to stay away from this man because he was contagious. But Yasodhara didn't. What she did was to insist that he go to the river and wash his hands, because she'd been tending the ill since she was 13 years old, so she knew what to do. So the significance of this story is that Siddhartha didn't leave right after their son was born, as some of the myths say. He wasn't a god or a messiah. He was a man. And he was a father. So we know from experience, those of us who are parents, we know that the longer he stayed, the harder it got. Then the dreams began. Yasodhara had a series of very powerful dreams. And these dreams carried one single message: the time has come. So what turned out to be the last dream, which involved Siddhartha's traveling clothes, Yasodhara got up during the night and she went to Siddhartha's attendant, Chana, and she woke him from his sleep. And she told him to ready two horses, one for him and one for the prince. Then she went back to the palace and she laid out Siddhartha's traveling clothes across his chair. And according to Thich Nhat Hanh, Yasodhara was awake when Siddhartha looked in on his wife and his son for the last time. But she knew that it would be too hard on him to say goodbye, so she pretended to be asleep. That according to Thich Nhat Hanh. So here again we see her great aspiration and her intention to honor the vow that she and Siddhartha had committed too in the timeless past. So she loved her husband deeply, and she knew that their time together was going to end this night. She knew that. So you can imagine the great effort that it took. So here again, in stark relief, we see the four components of inner strength being manifest in Yasodhara's story. So after her husband left, Yasodhara stopped wearing jewelry. She started wearing very, very simple clothes, even more simple than she wore already. She continued to meditate every day and to tend the poor. When she learned that Siddhartha was only eating one meal a day, she started only eating one meal a day. When she learned that he was fasting, she would fast. But she didn't engage in self-mortification, because if she had, who would go out into the poor villages and take care of the poorest of the poor? And who would take care of their son? So as prophesied by Dipankara Buddha, the man who left never returned. The man who did return 7 years later was not her husband. He was the Buddha. And Rahula, by this time, was a young boy. And Yasodhara knew that when Buddha left, he would be taking Rahula with him. She knew this because she had made up her mind that this was how it was going to be. Not once, but three times while Buddha was there, she said to her son Rahula, "Go and ask your father for your inheritance." And his inheritance, of course, was spiritual freedom. His inheritance was enlightenment. And so after the third time she sent him to ask about his inheritance, he didn't come back because he was accepted into the Sangha. And he took his place as a disciple of the Buddha. So now both her son and her husband were gone. So she was alone. But soon after Buddha left, there was a movement among a group of women to join Buddha's Sangha. And of course, Yasodhara wanted to be a part of that. She wanted to join them. But she was asked not to come with them, because her presence would complicate things. So once again, she acted according to the benefit of others. So she stayed behind. And it must have been incredibly painful and incredibly lonely. But as soon as the women's sangha was established, Yasodhara joined it. And quickly she became a very important leader. And of course she attained enlightenment. And according to the myth, like Buddha, Yasodhara attained supernormal powers and was able to recall infinite eras of the past. So again, that's just a reference to the fact that she was equal to Siddhartha in all ways. So in Buddhism, a great teacher's last teaching before their death is always important. Yasodhara died at the age of 70, and her last teaching was, "I am my own refuge. I am my own refuge." So what does that mean? I am my own refuge. Well, according to her myth, she attained complete spiritual liberation. So the I that she's referring to is not the small ego I, but it's the huge I that's not separate from anything else. So she was no longer bound to any concepts or beliefs in a separate self. So she was completely free. So we become our own refuge through the practice of the four teachings of Yasodhara. That's how we become our own refuge. Through vow, through social responsibility, through developing the four components of inner strength, and by accepting our limitations and working with them and within them. So the fifth teaching of Yasodhara is become your own refuge. And like I said, she died at the age of 70, and 2 years later, Buddha died. His last teaching was, be a lamp unto yourself. Be a lamp unto yourself. For my money, it's exactly the same teaching. So that's the story of Yasodhara. And for those of you who don't know, the story that I just told is not the tradition, is not the traditional story of the beginnings of Buddhism. In the traditional story, Yasodhara is completely left out. I mentioned Jacqueline Kramer earlier, that she's a Buddhist teacher and one of the people who is involved in recreating this, or reconstructing this myth. So when she was working with the traditional myth that was passed down to us, the one that leaves Yasodhara out, here's what she had to say about how that experience was for her. She wrote in an article, "Whenever I shared the Buddha story, no matter how I spun the tale, my students did not feel comfortable when I arrived at the part where Siddhartha leaves his wife and sleeping child to venture beyond the palace gate seeking the end of suffering. And they couldn't bring themselves to tell this part of the story to their children. I explained to my students, well, you know, it was a different time, it was a different place. These things were not unusual then. Or she would try, no, it's only a teaching myth. You know, we mustn't take it literally. Or she would try another tactic. She would say, Siddhartha's leaving speaks to the need to let go of all of our attachments. But she said no matter how hard she tried to justify it, it just didn't go over well. Not for her students, and not for her. We choose the myth that we decide to pass down. Consciously or unconsciously, we choose. It's a choice. 2,000 years ago, a myth was chosen that left Yasodhara out. That choice was made in ignorance. And the result was to create the image of a man who seems to be lacking something. And a 2,000-year-old myth kind of takes on a life of its own. We feel a little defenseless in the face of it. So we just repeat it. We feel obligated. But we have a choice. And we can reestablish Yasodhara into her rightful place in history. And by doing that one simple thing, Buddhist mythology opens up and reveals something wonderful about its founder, about his vow, and about his sacrifice, and about his humanity. So my granddaughter is 15 years old, and she identifies as a Buddhist. Now, this myth that's being reconstructed now, I don't think it'll make a profound difference in my life, because myths need time to sink into our bones But it could make a profound difference in her life, an even bigger difference in her sons and daughters' lives. So we have a choice. So I want to stop now and leave some time for discussion, comments, questions.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
I believe it will make a problem in all our lives. Not only our time, our time of the lifetime. Because I feel it already.
I do too, actually. I do too. It was a pleasure.
So I've come across both versions of that story too. And the one that Thich Nhat Hanh tells and the one that you're referencing, are those things that people discovered in different writings?
Yeah, bits and pieces of it. In very early writings of Buddhism, very early schools, and those schools are listed on the program. And the mythologist Clarissa Estes, she wrote the book "Women Who Run with the Wolves," and she talks about how these myths are dug up and pieced together, and we piece them together in whatever way speaks to us at that moment in time. So this myth, if you were to start working with Yasodhara's myth, it would reveal itself in a totally different way. So the various pieces of the myth that I came across and I started to work with, I started piecing them together in a way that they spoke directly to me at this moment in time. And that's how I came up with these five teachings. Because these are the teachings that just kind of reveal themselves to me. It was the guidance that I needed in my life right now. But what makes a myth so powerful is that whatever you need in your life right now, there's so much space and so much life in a myth that's 2,000 years old that when you start digging down into it, there's a relationship that forms. And within that relationship, you are able to get exactly what you need at that moment. It'll guide you there. And you're being supported by the myth, and at the same time, you're breathing life into the myth. And it becomes bigger and more available to other people. So it's really a beautiful thing. Yasodhara?
I'm not
good. No problem.
And I'd like to hear the same story told through her husband and how he responded to her according.
Yes. We don't get that story because Yasodhara was left out. Sure. Sure.
Like you said, so then her husband had, there was added a component of humanity. And he was stripped of that, of course, on an equity level. You could say, well, he was already the winner, so he lost a little bit, but he lost something.
Yeah, can I, from experiencing this story from a masculine standpoint, I was looking at it from his viewpoint actually more than the feminine, and that affected me to think of what he did at that moment to what he was giving up. So perhaps, I don't know, maybe you just saw it from the feminine side, but that was that to tear up a little bit. Actually, when she was describing it, so that's my take on it.
Thank you.
I just think it completes a more whole picture.
And that's exactly what it does. It gives us a fuller picture, flushes them out. And, you know, there's a reason why so much of it was left out. I mean, this is an oral tradition. They were passing down the teachings, and so they only passed down the story, because this was a teaching story, the story of Buddha. They only passed down the parts of the teaching that was of his story that was the most relevant to the teaching, and they left out everything else. But the mistake they made was that they left out something that was really, really important. To them at that time, the most important part was he was born, he realized the universality of suffering, because, you know, the very bare-bones story of Buddha's foresights and then leaving and his six-year search, that was, it's kind of just there to support the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. He realized the universality of suffering, and then he went out in search of answers, some relief for the suffering. So they were just they were just really concerned with passing down, you know, the what they saw as the essential points of the teaching. I don't think that, you know, leaving Yasodhara was out was anything that was done, you know, with malice. It was just done in ignorance.
I almost sort of suspect that is kind of a feminine orientated story. I think you're expanding on it. Back then, quite frankly, women, you didn't worry about them. They weren't, you know, they're mm-hmm. their own problem. Masculine mm-hmm. what matters. So mm-hmm. I can see the temptation for that very easily. I think I had to, you know, to expand it to the whole human race is a pretty cool thing to do. And it was interesting to say that your take on that broadens it. And mm-hmm. I, as I say, I think in the context of the time, it probably was very appropriate, because why bother with, you know, they didn't explain how to do it for dogs either. You know, I mean,
right. And it does miss to the stories that we tell embody our the core values of the culture. As far as the historical significance, myths do not claim any historical significance. You know, they're stories that pass on. Their function is to aid in transformation. So if the function of a myth is transformation, and another mythologist, I cannot remember her name right now, she said that myths change you. And if there has been no change, then there's been no contact with the myth. So if myths are that powerful, then, you know, we need to be very careful about the myths that we are embracing in our tradition. I can't remember if it was John Tarrant or Robert Aiken. I think it was Robert Aiken who said that the legends and myths of a tradition portray the self-image of that tradition. So that's pretty powerful. So we are, you know, we're building and forming and supporting a self-image of Buddhism. So we're not concerned really with historical value. Yeah.
I really like how that story transferred, like Buddha seeing external suffering and being different or better than, if you will, and going out and leaving. But for me, the story talks about he not only witnessed it, but had this relationship that, and in his spiritual path, he had to sacrifice and be able to go through that suffering and be a person and a mm-hmm. human, not an enlightened or better, you know, like that mm-hmm. power differential, that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So bringing that story for me, it just, I don't know, it really, for me, really embraces Buddhism.
Yeah, I think it does. And Stephen Baxter said that he's another Buddhist teacher. He said that Buddha's quest for the end of suffering was an existential quest. It was the existential questions that drove him. And those questions, I mean, they're really important. They're just as important as the physical. I'm not saying that what she was doing was more important, but he was seeking the existential answers because he saw that we need deep inner support, and where is that support going to come from? So he went out in search of that kind of support. Yeah.
I've been meditating on attachment quite firmly, or quite intensely for a while. It's been kind of a struggle for me, feeling like I'm still attached to people and or actions. And I think Buddhism kind of says pretty much to let go of attachments, but in the story I got that she was attached to her husband still and attached to her actions, and that was okay for her path.
Attachment is it's kind of a difficult word. Buddhism does not suggest that we withdraw. Particularly in Zen, the teaching is more to completely open up to whatever is happening. But you can't completely open up to this moment, this thing that's happening right now, if you're hanging on to something that happened in the past, or hanging on to an idea, or hanging on to an opinion. So when we talk about letting go of attachments, we're talking about your attachments to your old ideas, your attachments to your opinions, your attachments to all these things that we cling to in order to make us feel like we have a real solid self. It supports this self that moves through time. So there's never been the idea of detaching, removing yourself from some relationship. Zen is all about our relationships with each other, with the world, with the objects, everything that comes into this moment right now. We move right into that relationship. But when we're attached to, and this is when we use the word attached, when we're, our head is spinning around with all these ideas we have of things, like when I see you right now, if I'm thinking about who you were the last time I saw you or whatever interaction that we had at that time, I can't really be here with you right now, fresh and new, and move into this experience because I'm attached to some idea. So that's how that word attachment is used. But as far as your relationships, we move right into them. We completely disappear into our relationships, right into the moment, which is kind of the opposite. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Wanda. Based on listening to your story, it made me wonder if what kind of stories or myths we can develop out of Fredo's experience going through this as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if those stories could give us any insights into the role that children play in Buddhism.
And beautiful.
The role that Buddhism could play in a child.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a whole volumes of kids' books there. Yeah, I agree. So I think we have to turn it back over to Karen now for some announcements.